Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Don Brandt, and he will be speaking on Parenting Life Stage. So let's listen in on Don Brandt.
Those who weren't here yesterday, my name is Don Brandt, and the only reason I'm doing a class on family is because I'm working on a book on it. I asked if I could do a class on family. If you were looking for a class that I'm an expert on the topic, you should have come last week, because that's when I was actually teaching on my topic, which is evangelism. But I have a lot of opinions on this, and because I'm not coming to you as a licensed family counselor, but only a pastor and a father and three children, I recognize my lack of credentials in this area, and so as a result, I'm very pliable and very discussion-oriented. And so I do want this to be an opportunity for us to share some of our ideas on this. I have been doing a lot of reading on the subject in the last few months, a great deal of reading, and have collected a lot of information that I think will help stimulate discussion. Today, on this topic of boomers, busters, and the parenting life stage, this is one topic I've been speaking on now for a number of years. In connection with evangelism at congregations. And I'm not going to trouble you with the evangelism issue, but rather focus on some of the things that are unique about, in particular, the baby boom generation when it comes to parenting. For a lot of boomers, especially the vanguard boomers, which is considered the older half of the boomer generation, the boomer generation born between 1945 and 1964, there are about 77 million of them. They are the largest generation in American history. They always will be, at least in their lifetimes. And the older half of that is considered the vanguard boomers. And the vanguard boomers have had some very, very similar life experiences. Matter of fact, I think it's helpful from my own perspective to look at the boomer generation as having four major life stages that many boomers have in common with each other. The first significant life stage is the social consciousness life stage, the 60s and the 70s, when the great majority of boomers were impacted by social issues in one of two ways. Either they were impacted by ending up in Vietnam or involved in the draft, or they were impacted by that in terms of their resistance to the war, whether it was a sincere or a self-serving resistance, kind of dependent upon the individual. You know, one interesting thing in reflecting back on the late 60s and 70s was to realize in retrospect that the single decision that did the most to undermine the anti-war movement was Nixon's decision to get rid of the draft. And it was interesting, my brother, who is a draft resister, was one of these people who was seriously disillusioned to find out that this anti-war movement that he had a great deal of pride in being part of was in many respects extremely self-serving. Once there was no longer a draft, it was like the bottom fell right out from under the anti-war movement in this country. And my brother still is a little bitter about that, because that's been a lot of years. Just he's one of these faithful left-wing radicals. He's a part of the vanishing breed. But the social consciousness life phase really impacted boomers in terms of a certain idealism had been built in the late 60s as to the opportunity that this largest of all American generations had to impact society. And, of course, it ended up with an incredible amount of disillusionment. An incredible amount of cynicism developed in the late 60s and early 70s in terms of all American institutions. It started with the government, it went to education, it also, of course, impacted their view of the institutional church. And when you ask yourself the question now, how did that life phase have anything to do with the present parenting stage? Here's one way in which it impacts the parenting stage. For many boomers, parenting was their chance to create a kind of, within their own household, the kind of society they found out they had no opportunity to create at large. In other words, the cynicism they felt in terms of their inability to create a just environment around them, and finding out that no matter what you do in life, that the odds seem to be against you in terms of creating the kind of environment, the kind of society that you think there should be. For many boomers, there was that sense when parenting finally arrived that, well, maybe in my own household, I can still be idealistic, can still have those incredible expectations and standards that I set for my own children. The second major life stage, and this is has significant impact too, is the spiritual awakening life stage. Spiritual awakening in the United States was late 60s and early 70s and mid 70s. It really started in Southern California, but had national implications. We call it the Jesus movement. Did you know that Rolling Stone magazine did a survey of boomers and found out that 22% of the boomers they surveyed identified themselves as Christians as a direct result of the Jesus movement? And there are many people, now for most of these people that were impacted by the Jesus movement, and by the way, the Lutheran results of this were like Lutheran Youth Alive and Lutheran Youth Encounter. Every mainline denomination to some degree in the whole, with that generation, which at that point was in youth ministry and single young adult ministry age group, every single mainline denomination to some degree was impacted by the Jesus movement, even though the Jesus movement began in the non-denominational or evangelical or fundamentalist churches. And so we have a tremendous amount of boomers that, majority of them, by the way, became Christians and then left the church because the Jesus movement was notorious for not following through. You know, they got people to make a decision for Christ, but often never integrated them into an ongoing Christian community. And of course, it was the worst time of life to expect these people to become active in a church, because with any age segment, any life stage, the group that has the lowest level of church involvement is single young adult. And of course, that's exactly the age in which boomers were being impacted by the Jesus movement. But this spiritual awakening did leave a lot of boomers with relatively positive memories, even though they never became integrated into the body of Christ and they fell away after they were impacted by the Jesus movement. By the way, I myself am in ministry as a result of the Jesus movement. I've never been a fundamentalist, but it's because of fundamentalists that I was brought back into the faith. Well, a great many people, the boomers, as in terms of how their spiritual awakening impacts their identity as parents now, a lot of them are very, very receptive to the whole concept of Christian values being an important part of parenting, and are finding that because of the roots, or because of the seeds that were planted in their young adult years or teenage years by virtue of the Jesus movement, there is a receptivity and an interest in the place in which Christian values will play in their parenting role. And a lot of them, of course, the birth of the children has been a reason for them to return to church. The third major life stage was the yuppie or professional career stage. It happened in the 1980s. And of course, was they talk about, I mentioned later, that boomers are identified as the 3D generation: delayed marriage, divorced couples, and deferred childbearing. Delayed marriage, divorced couples, and deferred childbearing. Well, the deferred childbearing and the delayed marriage, of course, were part of the yuppie career focus of the 80s. A lot of people in the boomer generation very consciously put off marriage and put off parenting because their first priority at that point was to establish themselves in their careers. And, of course, there are a lot of implications when you talk about having put all this off. We are ending up, by far, compared to any previous generation, boomers have been far older, especially middle class and upper middle class boomers have been far older at the birth of their first child than previous generations. I mean, we're talking a significant difference here. We're talking about, you know, being almost becoming the norm for many boomers having been in their 30s before the first child was born, for very many of them. And that, of course, has, maybe you could throw this one back to me. What do you think, when you have a generation that is older than previous generations at the birth of the first child, how does that impact parenting? And I'm not looking for any one answer here. There's no right or wrong answer. What are some ideas on your part? How does that impact? Let's say the average parent for first child is 29, whereas in previous generations it might have been 22. How does that change a parent's perspective or how they approach parenting? Any ideas?
Fewer children.
Okay, very important part is fewer children. Just the biological realities of having waited.
Friends of ours are dealing with adolescents and aging problems with aging parents at the
midlife,
same time.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Okay, the rest home issues. At the same time the kids become teenagers,
yeah.
When you have the least energy to address the problems of
college parents. And retirement and college, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Retirement and college, yeah.
Yeah.
So planning for your retirement and planning for your child's. Your last two children going out the door at college.
My kids are doing that.
Right.
I think they're approached parenting as another profession that they had.
Okay.
It wasn't just that you just had children and you did it.
Right.
They were very professional.
Yeah, they're very perfectionistic, many of them. Parent magazine used the expression professional parents trying to raise super kids. And they approach it as a very professional role.
I think they're more financially established, so they buy more material things.
Good point.
And the kids, so it's a whole issue of buy.
Yes. Yeah.
And why should they not have everything they want?
Right.
Kids staying longer in homes now, do you think, or not?
Yes, definitely. Just because of the cost of housing, pure and simple. The issue now in most metropolitan communities where you really have to have a roommate to get out the door when you're 21 with the kind of income you can expect here, and you almost have to have one or two roommates to be able to do it.
I remember giving counsel to a single father whose first son was like in the seventh year plan of his college education.
Okay, right.
He wanted to know how many years it took me to get out, and I said, well, it took four. And I said, but the norm is a little longer, five, six, ten.
Yeah.
And now our first son is on, entered the seventh.
Well, of course, in the California system now, some of the colleges are dictating that.
Yeah.
Because of the overload of the ability to offer all courses.
It gets expensive.
Yes, it does. Tuition doesn't go down.
A lot of it's career change, too. I mean, back when people took five, I guess you can always say back when. But it was a five-year plan, usually with someone who came from a poor household and did not have the financial resources, and so they had to work more and take less hours.
Right.
But today it seems to be like, what's the career of the day?
We think the universities could at least give us tuition breaks the fifth, sixth, every year tuition go down.
Or give us credit for credits, even though they're not, these are 15 credits we can't use towards a major, but, we'll graduate with 230 credits.
Right. Right. Last stage, and I think the stage that they're in now, is the combination midlife crisis and parenting. And this is one other implication of delayed marriage and deferred childbearing, is that midlife crisis is simultaneous with the raising of children. And I know midlife crisis, the whole concept of midlife crisis is, it's hard to pin that one down. Everybody has different opinions about when it hits, whether it's true or perceived or all of that. I think it's pretty true. I think I've been in one for a few years already. But the interesting thing, midlife crisis for any generation is a time where values tend to be looked at anew. There's a new evaluation of priorities in life. And of course, there's the old stereotype, for a typical male, for example, that's going through midlife crisis, he either shifts towards more altruistic concerns or finds an 18-year-old to have an affair with, right? But something has to be done. It's kind of, there's enough of a crisis developing here that something has to be done. New priorities in life suddenly rise to the surface. And very often, the old stereotype with men, and of course this is becoming increasingly true with women too, who are on the career track, is the old stereotype was that the shift was from a career focus to a non-career focus. Now, the fact is that when you have this generation that's having children at a later age than any previous generation, you have millions of boomers where the midlife crisis is hitting at the same time that they're actually already in or beginning the parenting life stage. And as a result, there's a natural shift to the home and the house and the children as the life's new priority. And this phenomena of midlife crisis simultaneous with parenting is contributing to a much higher percentage of obsessive parents than we have were used to in previous generations. A much higher percentage of parents who are so incredibly emotionally wound up in the lives of their children that we can see both positive and negative implications of that. And I don't want to make it all negative, because it's not. But there are some very positive results of that too. For me, the beginning of this new life stage was the birth of our first child. Jason was born in Family Hospital in Milwaukee, which is a downtown hospital in the Milwaukee area in 1982, most hospitals were still doing the traditional delivery, in the delivery room, and where the husband would be outside. But Family Hospital was one of the more innovative for 1982 in the Milwaukee area. And the Family Hospital already had the birthing room experience. Okay, and so, and I sometimes think that that sense of frustration I had during Sue's, this is Sue here, by the way, during Sue's 9-month pregnancy, in terms of this inability to bond with the child that was still in her womb, kind of set me up for a really intense birth experience. And so we had this pretty tastefully decorated room with curtains in the window and an upholstered rocking chair off to the side. And the idea, of course, was as soon as Sue delivered, that there would be an opportunity for mom and dad to bond with the child before the nurse got in the way and do the things that she needed to do. And so I still remember, my original idea was I called the church office and said, I'll be in tomorrow. I only need one day off for this. And lo and behold, they didn't see me for 3 days. And Sue still, recounts that time. Once she got through the delivery, which was extremely painful, as they all are, she was very, very willing and very eager to have me hold Jason. And she was pretty exhausted at that point. And so I took Jason in my arms rather clumsily and went over to that rocking chair. And she says that about 90 minutes, I just stared at him and rocked. Mm-hmm. For me...
Every day, I got to feed him, that's all.
Yeah, right.
Otherwise, Dad had him the whole time.
Yeah, it's one of those hospitals you can come in and the father can get the baby anytime out of the nursery, right? And so I'd show up either all day, show up or get him, and come over to her room. And there was a rocking chair in her postpartum room, too. And so I just sit there and rock the whole time. She only got him to breastfeed. So when I look back on that, I realize, one way I compare that experience for myself emotionally, because that was an incredibly emotional experience for me, is I compare it to my re-entry into the Christian faith. And for me, coming back into the Christian faith was about a 4 or 5 month experience. Happened back in, back in 1970. But becoming a father took 90 minutes, in terms of a changed identity. So in 4 months I perceived myself from an agnostic, changed from an agnostic to a professing Christian. But from a husband and not a father to a father, that was the emotional intensity that 4 months compressed into 90 minutes. It's just an overwhelming experience for me. And as I go around the country and share that story as part of evangelism stuff that I do, it's such commonplace experience. I mean, finding there's absolutely nothing unique about what I went through. Some sociologists even talk about the impact on fathers, the boomer fathers, of being present at the birth of their children in a birthing room experience, that one experience has in a significant way contributed to the phenomena of the modern nurturing father. And whereas our parents, for example, the typical birth situation was that the father was never present, was out in the waiting room, and saw the baby after the fact, some sociologists claim that the birthing room experience has really had an impact, a significant emotional impact, on the degree to which fathers try to play more of the nurturing role than might have been true of their own fathers. When I think back on my own childhood, for example, I can only think of two instances in which my father and I spent time alone. I was one of three children. And one was he had one day off and we went bowling. And the other one was that we had a vacation situation, by this time I was in junior high, where he and I were together and the rest of the family could only come up on weekends. My father was just a classic parish pastor. We just saw him at dinner. But you really sensed that that was part of a generation when there was not a serious effort made at spending time alone with each of the children, or even not that much serious effort made in time with the family either. And we know now, for example, that there was more leisure time for the typical parents in the 60s than there is now in the 90s. There is less discretionary leisure time in the 90s than there was in the 60s. So one way in which things have changed is in terms of typical life. Mothers, of course, have always been nurturing. But we are beginning to see an increased emphasis in the nurturing role on the part of fathers, which I think is one of the very healthy outcomes of this, partly contributed to by the fact that it's deferred childbearing, that it came later in life, and that I think there are some more mature people that are having kids than, of course, if everybody compared to everybody having them, 21. There is something to say for the maturity level of parents who are 29 or 30, whatever that might be the case. families. And it's interesting, too, that the corporate America has really picked up on this phenomenon. You know, when the largest generation in American history enters the nesting stage, corporations take note, right? And for example, here we have the, you know, the interesting thing is in terms of the aging boomer generation, the Gap was a corporation that began in 1969. And the Gap, it was always marked into boomers at every life stage. Notice it's been rained on, fought over, lost twice and replaced at least twice more, but it's still the only one you wear, and now it comes in his size too for every generation. Baby Gap. And of course they have Kid Gap too. You know, because as we age, of course, they don't just leave it at Baby Gap because these kids get older, you know, and so they have Kid Gap. And so the idea of the generation trying to, the company, you know, trying to market to, at every life stage, to keep the loyalty of this generation. Or Cherokee clothing. When it comes to dressing, my son and I have the identical philosophy, make yourself comfortable. And Cherokee man. And of course, classic. And I remember the first ad I ever saw that had a father and a baby that I took notice of. I believe it was Sony Electronics. It was some stereo system. And I remember there was this man, I've never even seen a man in the flesh with a build like this. I mean, this guy was, and bare-chested, just pants on. He was holding this little infant newborn. And it was such a striking contrast between the size of the man and the size of the baby. And that was the first time I took notice of the marketing, the whole marketing approach to fathers in the nurturing role. And that's something that's become very, very commonplace, of course, over the last 10 years. I received in the mail, for example, 2 years ago from Chrysler Corporation, a whole big packet. And open up the brochure, it says, fortunately, there's an easier way to protect your family. And it's a picture of athletic protective gear over all the members, all the kids, and as well as the dog. And then it opens up and it says the 1993 minivan lineup from Chrysler. And of course, it has all these protective features, you know, including the built-in child seat. And of course, we didn't own a Chrysler, so I thought it was interesting that we got this. Inside also was a free issue of Parent magazine. Okay. And it said if I went down and I took a test drive, I would get a free 1-year subscription to Parenting magazine. And if I actually bought it, and if I did a test drive, I would also get a $50 gift certificate to Toys R Us. So I thought that's pretty good example of niche.
You talk about market. That protection thing in family. One of the things I've noticed in the last 3 or 4 years in our preschool, as the mothers come, is that the vehicles have gotten big again. They all come in Suburban,
yes,
vans,
that's right.
Ford Explorers.
Right.
Whereas before they were the economy kind of cars.
Right. Yeah, the gas mileage, you know, sensible cars.
And that's what the mothers say.
Good for the environment.
This. And mothers, when they see it, feel sorry for me because I drive a car without air with 180,000. Yeah. Oh, Pastor, we had to get this because we have little kids and it's safer.
Notice this, and notice how it marketing often is not even practical in terms of its appeal to nesting stage parents. Sometimes it's just purely trying to address the emotions. And the product has nothing to do with the life stage. So, for example, we have here the picture. The quality here, but notice the photograph is apparently, you know, it's presumably a father and a mother. Mother's in the bathtub, and the baby is in the flesh. Right there, leaning over the bathtub, and they're both staring adoringly at their baby. That's a bathtub. It's in the bathtub. And then notice what the ad's for. It's Liz Claiborne perfume. And the caption is, this is the caption. Reality is the best fantasy of all. What is that suggesting? What does that have to do with the picture? What do you think? Reality is the best fantasy of all.
Perfect family.
Okay, reality is parenting here, right? Reality is this beautiful, adorable baby in their lives. And notice, and think about the generation here. You know, this ad is 3 years old. And think about the generation here. The generation is the generation that's always focused on the experiential, right? Whether it's drugs or sex, it's the experiential. And the pursuit of the experience, of the emotional experience. And notice the implication here. The final discovery compares to parenting. Nothing. And this is reality. and this is the best it's ever been. And I think one more little clue here as to that sense that marketers have, that you've got some very, very emotional parents out there. If we can tap into that, we can sell them stuff. We can sell them stuff. Because they're very, very obsessive when it comes to this new role they have in life. Boomers and busters. Professional parents trying to raise super kids. I mentioned that Parenting Magazine article. And Disney Corporation now employs more animators than any time since the late 1930s. Now, I think one very, very interesting thing is I was starting to hear in the press 3 years ago the complaint that despite the fact that those few G-rated movies that came out were making millions of dollars, Hollywood still wasn't producing very many G-rated movies. Have you noticed what's happened the last 3 years?
Boom.
A complete turnaround. And they finally, and because Disney got back into the annual animated film and was just cleaning up. And finally, all the other studios have come in line. And now we have almost every, at least every other month, we have a major production that's G-rated. And I think the entertainment industry was a classic example of an industry that was late in getting on the bandwagon. They really were late. And part of the problem was you have kind of a two-year delay from the time that you decide you're going to do something to the time it's actually released as a movie. I think Disney, what's happened to Disney Corporation is a classic example. From 1986 to 1988, polls found out that people that were being surveyed said the popularity of, quote, staying at home had tripled in 3 years. Popularity of, quote, staying at home. Of course, we know about the cocooning phenomena. Faith Popcorn coined that term, cocooning. And she said in the 90s, in the 80s it was cocooning, and then the term she uses for the 90s now is burrowing. It's gone from cocooning to burrowing. It's only intensified. And of course, what contributes to that intensification of that kind of home life is the crime rate, you know, the AIDS epidemic, all the things that are going on out there that seem to be totally out of control. And so there's an increased focus and emphasis then on the home environment. In 1988, the San Francisco Chronicle said babies were the new fad in American life. Faith Popcorn said, yuppie dumb is out. Family life is the latest rage. And of course, now it's already been around for a while. So, and that was a quote from back in 1990. But a lot of boomer and buster parents are scared. Listen to this quote from a 40-year-old parent who recently returned to church only because he had a kid. He said, quote, the 1960s were good to me. But then you wake up from that and you realize you're going to have to raise your children and you want them to have some values. What a hypocrite. Oh my gosh, I enjoyed playing around in the 60s, but not my kids. They're going to have some values. The book, the Wall Street Journal had an article that was headlined, this was only a couple of years back, the 60s generation, once high on drugs, warns its children. Right? What about this from the book Generations? Grown-up boomer radicals who once delighted in shocking their own moms and dads now surprise themselves with their own strictly perfectionist approach to child nurture. And for some boomers, parenthood is the whole attempt then to create the kind of environment at home that they were never able to successfully create in society at large. You know, there's a tremendous amount of idealism in the late 60s. I mean, tremendous amount of cynicism, of course, to all institutions. But a tremendous idealism over the opportunity that this generation, by its sheer size, had to affect change. And of course, a lot of disillusionment when things never really panned out. And as a result, I think we find the parenting stage has become a fairly conservative trend among boomers. Even those that once prided themselves on being very, very left-wing in orientation now have become raving traditionalists when it comes to good old-fashioned values. And of course, this is not unusual. I think it'd be fairly safe. You could study a number of generations and find the parenting life stage. It tends to be a shift towards more conservative values. But I think it's even more striking for the boomers because so many of them used to pride themselves in being such progressives. Faith Popcorn wrote, traditional values that boomers used to criticize, like family and marriage, have now become priorities. But of course, teaching traditional values in this kind of a culture is becoming very difficult. And we spoke, for those of you that are in yesterday's class, we talked a lot about how things have changed in our culture and how the kinds of cultural institutions that we used to be able to count on as parents, as being allies with us in the parenting task, no longer seem to be healthy and viable. And I think a classic case, of course, is what's happened to the education system. Now, I'm not sharing this in any way to criticize people who choose education for a career, because, you know, Lord knows we need all the conscientious people we can get in the educational system. But I still remember that time in which there was a... I remember reading an article about one history book that had a timeline in the history book that had over 300 key events in U.S. history that were mentioned and were put on the timeline. And out of 300 key events, only 5 had anything at all to do with the role that religion played in American history. And included in that timeline was the first professional ice hockey game. I mean, we're not talking strictly major events here on this timeline. They considered the birth of professional ice hockey to be more significant than many events that happened in the religious life of the United States. And of course, there was finally that backlash, probably partly by virtue of so many people becoming parents, that said, you know, there comes a point in which our attempt to bend over backwards to keep church and state separate tends to backfire on us, because we tend to disown all religious values when you reach a certain point. You tend to become so secular in your orientation in an educational system, there comes the time when you don't feel you can ever bring up values lest you offend anybody, unless somebody feels singled out. You know, Stephen Carter tells the story in his work in one of our class sessions this week is going to be raising Christian children in a culture of disbelief. And of course, Stephen Carter's book, Culture of Disbelief, tells the story about the public school teacher in Colorado who was admonished by the school board and ordered to remove his personal copy of his Bible from his school desk. He never read out of it to his kids, but he had his personal copy of his Bible on his school desk, and he was ordered to either remove that Bible from the classroom or to be disciplined, to be disciplined by the school board. And what was interesting, Stephen Carter mentions that a book on Native spirituality and a book on the occult were allowed to remain in the school library. But along with that teacher being told to remove his personal Bible, he was told to remove every book from the classroom library that pertained to Christianity. And it was interesting that we've tried so hard to be very accepting and open and to never allow for any particular religion to have a monopoly in public life, that we've come to the point now, according to Carter, and I believe with him, I believe now that we discriminate more against the majority religion than we do minority religions. I believe we've reached the point in the United States now where Christianity is more severely discriminated against than minority faiths. So in our fears, in our paranoia over the majority religion coming to dominate secular life, we have actually come to the point now where I believe Christianity is unfairly discriminated against. And what closely, and the tragedy is that when the baby is thrown out with the bathwater, not just Christianity, but all values that would be stereotyped as Christian values, of course, are thrown out with it. And again, there's the danger, that fear that in the public education realm, that if we talk about values like love and charity, that would be perceived by some people as a form of religious indoctrination. And so we tend to throw out the values along with the belief system. I believe it's time for us to change direction on that one. And it's time for us not to be so hypersensitive or concerned about how people might feel nervous or uneasy when we bring up things that relate to our faith. I think it's time for us to get back to that. We might have become more conservative of late, but it's interesting, we still, as parents, stress a different set of values than previous generations. Now, this is pretty interesting. There was a survey done both in 1924 and in 1990, and this is on traits that mothers believe are important to instill in their children. So I want to shift now to this whole issue of how are parents different in terms of the values that they try to instill in their children from 1924. Okay, so we have here today and over here, 1924, and hopefully we'll find a marking pen. And over here we have traits. Oh, that one's not much better. Okay. No, we'll keep trying. Maybe red will work. And the first trait here is the trait of independence. So the question being asked mothers in the survey, first survey is 1924, second survey is 1990, is how many of them consider independence to be an important trait to instill in their children? Back in 1924, 25% of the mothers said that was an important trait to instill in their children. 25%. And today, 76%. Now let's talk about that trait. What are we seeing here in terms of any changed focus in parenting with this particular trait? What does this indicate? Communities? It's not a trick question. I would throw that out as we were discussing. It's not a trick question. There's no right or wrong answer. What do you think? Independence.
We operate less as a group or less as a family, more independently. That indicates that there's fewer children in the family.
Good point. Good point. We don't have to contend with six siblings having to share all the time.
That's right.
Yeah.
Could in 1924 be an assumed thing that came out of family as opposed to something that we struggle to be intentional about with?
Well, they actually used the term, in their survey, they used the term. They asked mothers in 1924, do you consider independence to be an important trait to instill in your children? Okay, so they did ask the same question, both surveys.
And don't forget, in 1924, the average high school student didn't leave town.
Right.
They stayed where they were, so they all...
Right.
So a family was more dependent on each other.
Okay. So what's the positive side? Let's talk about positive and negative side. What's the positive, hopeful positive side of more independence from kids? Can you see anything positive in that?
Less dependence.
Less dependence. I think, you know, I wonder, in a world which is becoming increasingly fragmented and confused and chaotic and dangerous, there is, in terms of just emotional stability, the need for children to feel that they can cope without always having a support structure around them. You know, a single young adulthood is a tough time. And, of course, so I can see some advantages there. What's the downside? What's the downside?
Independence with what values? Excuse me, in 1924, you had a set of values that was that were very clear in this country, much clearer than they are today.
Right.
What's the values of these independent people?
Yeah. Good point. Going off on your own. Yeah.
I see independence from authority. In Washington State, mores are defined by the RCW, the Revised Code of Washington, Washington Administrative Codes, and it's all. Churches have their own mores, and the independence that I see is that nobody's going to tell me what to do.
Yeah. Okay. All right, the next trait was tolerance. There are only four of these. Trait of tolerance. Back in 1924, the trait of tolerance, only 6% of mothers said that was important. And in 1990, it was 47%.
I'm surprised it's not higher than 47%.
Yeah, right. So what do you think? Well, it's obvious what the positive side of this is. Just more accepting people that are very different. But what? Is there any downside? Is there any downside to increased tolerance?
Like your sexual roles or values.
What are you accepting?
Okay, what are you accepting, right?
You don't take a stand on things.
Right.
Anything goes.
Right.
Live and let live.
Right. It's like Alan Bloom's book on, what was the title of his book on education in America? So the primary value in American education has become tolerance, the primary value. And to the point where anything is accepted. And there are no longer any standards.
And you get the fear of what we were talking about, the fear of being intolerant.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that becomes now the worst accusation anybody can make to you in the public realm in American life now, is to accuse you of being intolerant.
Yeah.
Right. For instance, that the overwhelming, we're going to be talking about Dan Quayle a little bit later in the week, but the overwhelmingly negative response on the part of the media to Dan Quayle's comment about the Murphy Brown episode.
Intolerant towards unwed mothers.
Right. He's been intolerant towards alternative family structures and single mothers. And how dare he say anything that would imply criticism toward anyone that had made a choice to be a single mother? I thought that was a very, very negative, overwhelmingly negative response by the press. And the third trait is loyalty to church. Loyalty to church. You can all sense where this is going, right? I wonder what the results would be on this one. Back in 1924, 50% said this was an important trait. And then back in 1990, it was 22%. And of course, when we're talking about our struggle with values, I tried all the pens in. It's a bit yellow. When we're talking about our struggle with values, this is very, very significant. And this is one of those areas I can talk with some authority on when we're talking about the church. The model now, I believe it's fair to say that one of the biggest disadvantages the ELCA has. Is the fact typically ELCA church is as small as it is. Effective ministry now to younger cultures, whether it's children's ministry or youth ministry or single adult ministry, increasingly we are finding it happening that the large churches, who are finding the small churches simply don't have the resources to do an effective job. And we're finding a lot of parents in the nesting stage really sense this, or at least they assume this, whether or not they've tested it or not, they assume this. And we're finding that the small churches are having a very difficult time because the parents that are out there, they're church shopping, that are looking for a place to raise their children, are really deferring to the larger congregations that they're convinced would have the adequate resources to provide for their kids. And I was reading a book recently that said that one of the keys to a lot of evangelical churches and their effectiveness with youth is that they so intentionally focus on youth ministry that they actually create youth subcultures within the congregation. And I know, I've worked enough years in youth ministry in my lifetime to know that one of the single most important things you can do in youth ministry is to establish and to maintain a large enough peer group that the youth group becomes the primary source of social relations for a teenager. When you can do that, and I've had parents, when I've been able to pull that off, that are just so grateful, when it gets to the point when the youth group becomes the single most significant peer group in the life of an adolescent, you've got something there that's becoming increasingly unique in our culture, and I think increasingly important in the raising of our children. And I have to tell you that it's... I think it's bad enough out there that some parents, I wouldn't argue with them if they would need to move on to another church to find that. It's more important to me, for example, that my kids grow up Christian than it is that they grow up Lutheran. And I believe that the challenges that we face, and the challenges that my kids face in their future are such that I have a lot of sympathy for parents where that's their primary agenda either in terms of the church they're looking for. A lot of sympathy. Because it's become harder and harder to find that kind of church.
I see this happening very much in a church that's close to us. But I don't know that much about the church except I sit from a distance and see their activities. But I wonder if we have more time spent on thinking synod than they think. They don't think so. I mean, I don't know.
They're thinking more synod than church, you mean?
Well,
like local church?
Yeah, no, they think more, well, we'll spend our money here on our youth. We have to worry about synod first, and then after that, if we've got something left.
Oh, that's
right. I mean, that's what I'm asking. I don't know.
Well, the key...
Yeah, the church you're talking about is not a Lutheran, you mean?
The key
in youth ministry really is the local church. It's not some larger organization. In larger organizations, which I've worked with before, there's only a small percentage of those that participate where that becomes, where that really changes them, because perhaps they're in the leadership of that organization. The real key to youth is really the local church. what happens on the local.
Are you saying that some of the resources are going, in the Lutheran Church, the resources go to the synod?
This is what I'm wondering.
Whereas independent churches don't have to do that.
This happens to the mission church, but they sure have.
Sure. A non-denominational church, of course, tends to keep a lot of its money at home, but the typical non-denominational church is sending more money to foreign missions than a typical ELCA church. Even if you
the community church, I mean the large non-denominational.
Large non-denominational. They're actually sending a higher percentage. But it is true that you're not paying denominational dues, obviously, if you're a non-denominational church, and so that does give you more discretionary money. But I don't think that makes a difference.
I don't know what they're doing, but I know there's no comparison.
Last loyalty is strict obedience. And you can probably guess which direction this one went to. Strict obedience in 1924, 45% says it was a very important trait, and 1990, only 15%. Now, what's the, first of all, is there a positive side? Can you give me a positive reason? I mean, is there a positive outcome? Is there a benefit of that kind of a trend change in that value before we talk about the downside?
They won't burn their hands in the stove, anyway.
Yeah, right. Not as much corporal punishment, at least in the middle class household. What's the downside?
Lack of questioning, which can be good.
What do you mean lack of questioning?
Well, like kids who just accept everything and don't think.
Just are trained.
Yeah.
Okay.
The downside of strict obedience.
No, okay. What's the downside of us, our emphasis now being away from strict obedience?
Disrespect for
obedience.
Yeah.
Okay, disrespect for
order. For order or for law or okay. For. Yeah.
Kids that are out of control.
Okay.
They're more difficult to teach. I think.
Yeah.
I mean, you see it in the school system.
Yeah.
The lack of obedience.
Yeah.
I'm not a teacher.
Less sense of direction.
Okay.
On their own part because they're just.
Right. A lot of kids are being asked to make adult decisions long before they're adults.
Right.
This parents bending over backwards. Well, what do you want, Joshua?
Compromise and diversity.
Oh, parents. Well, I know Don and I have both undoubtedly had talked to parents where we found that their decision not to join a church is because the kids weren't really excited about the place. And we sensed in the discussion that there's this idea in which it was always understood when these parents went church shopping that the decision would be the child's. Or parents, for example, when you have parents that are involved in church and kids that are not in Sunday school, and the parents' response is, well, Joshua really doesn't get a lot out of it.
He
just doesn't want to go. It's too hard to get Joshua up on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
You know, the poor kid has to get up all week for school, you know, and he really doesn't want to go to Sunday school.
Excuse me. And having four boys, and I have all four sitting on the front row with my wife in a very traditional setting, sometimes raises people say, how do you do that? And I think you can honestly say the oldest now is 22, 19, 17, 14. And we can honestly say on very rare occasion, you probably count on the hand in the course of a year, have they balked at wanting to go to church or wanting to sit in the front row. That it's an expectation we set early on, and mm-hmm. we told them how important this was in our family and should be in their life. And,
yeah.
and they, by and large, I think they bought into it.
All I said was, guys, this is my job, and you're going.
I might have said that once or twice.
But
I've always been amazed at that because my kids have had so much freedom and have never really picked up on rebellious stance. In fact, our oldest son, I think, is involved in intra-varsity, a very conservative campus group.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's no Lutheran active. There is a Lutheran pastor on campus, but they don't do anything. They don't create the community setting. It's very high church kind of setting.
Right.
And
I know about that. I used to work
in
council ministry.
And so he is much more religious conservative than I am, and much more in terms of this obedience kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of a little scary.
Well, you know, I thought about that, you know, and take seriously see, by the way, take seriously the evangelical Christian organizations that are strong and work with college students, because we don't have anything comparable in the main line. And I thought about that. I thought, could I deal with my kids becoming born-again Christians? And I say, yeah, I can deal with that. Yeah. I've been through that. I can do it. I can handle that. And I'd much rather deal with that than deal with kids that have become confirmed agnostics from the word go. And please don't realize that the groups that are doing the best in this country with youth and single young adults are not mainline groups. And in many cases, in terms of a peer group for our kids, unless you belong to a very large mainline church, that would be the exception. But in many cases, the only chance we have for our kids to find a Christian peer group is an evangelical Christian peer group, whether it's Campus Crusade for Christ or InterVarsity or Navigators.
Fellowship of Christian Athletes.
Fellowship of Christian
Athletes.
Which is no
more just for athletes.
Right. They're just doing a better job. I mean, it's just pure and simple. Yeah.
No, I've always perceived those groups as...
Oh, and Young Life. Young Life is coming up. Go ahead.
As doing a little brainwashing. And maybe that's incorrect, but that's always sort of turned me off of those.
I think brainwashing would be...
I think legalistic. I think that there's a lot of legalism, a lot of black and white kinds of answers in those groups. And as I tried to observe my son, who's been just the one that's been in school forever, you know, went to ASU and to Midland Lutheran, now finishing up at Northern Arizona to be a teacher, that it seems like the issue is community.
Yeah.
A group of people who have, and whether it be Lutherans or Baptists or Assembly of God, if you've been raised in a church setting and Christian values, they're all the same. They really are. I mean, maybe the way they practice their baptism is different. They're speaking in tongues or music might be different. But the values in terms of faith, in terms of community, in terms of trying to do right things or trying to lead a godly life, exist within these circles. But yeah, sometimes I struggle with the legalism aspect.
And some are more legalistic than others. For example, Young Life is not terribly legalistic at all. They're fairly moderate. So that's valid. I'd like to finish here with some of the challenges that are unique to this generation when it comes to parenting. First, as obsessive parents, we desire to spend more time with the kids, but actually have less discretionary time than our parents did. In 1965, parents spent 30 hours a week with their family. 30 hours a week. I'm sorry, with their kids. 30 hours a week with their kids. Back in 1965. In 1993, it's 17 hours. Dropped from 30 to 17. And we'll talk later in the week about the issue of time. Second, as obsessive parents, we want to provide our children with every opportunity, but we often overschedule and overcommit them, and they lose their opportunity to be kids.
Yeah.
Just classic, it's happening all over the country, you know, these overcommitted kids, every conceivable sports activity, they're on the team, you know. And a lot of this is the paranoia parents feel over their kids having unstructured time. And I don't want to criticize, I mean, that's valid. I mean, that's a valid concern. With kids these days, there is the danger of too much discretionary time by virtue of what's out there. You know, there's some incredible things out there. But let's not go to the extreme where our kids are so regimented, it's like they don't have a childhood. We just rob them of that. Third, as obsessive parents, we strive to make them happy, but we are reluctant to assert a healthy level of authority. They are allowed to make decisions their parents should be making for them. For example, church. But that's only one example. Too often we tend to...
Sitting still in church.
Sitting still in church. Too often we bend over backwards to make these kids happy, and as a result, we're trying to be popular parents is what we're trying to do, because that's so important to us. We're so obsessive that it's too important to us to be popular with our kids. And as a result, and I'm definitely guilty of that myself, and so as a result, we tend to not insist on a certain level of behavior or a certain type of conduct. Fourth, as obsessive parents, we look for countless ways to nurture and love our children, but what's lacking is guidelines, discipline, and character formation. We look for a lot of ways to nurture. We look for a lot of ways to prove to our kids that we love them and care for them, And I think as a generation, we tend to be, have a lot more physical contact with our kids than perhaps our parents did with us. At least I know that's true of Scandinavians.
And Irish, too. The only contact I ever had was usually...
So that's the positive part. But the downside there is very related to the thing I just mentioned before this, and that is that lack of discipline, that lack of guidelines, and that lack of serious attempt at character formation.